p.m. Eastern. It is truly intelligent media for the politically aware.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
Many years from now, would you be willing to trade all the days from this day to that for one chance, just one chance, to come back here and tell our enemies that they may take our lives, but they'll never take our freedom?
The future is uncertain. I know this. Death is inevitable. I know this. But one thing is certain, as free men, it is our right to live unencumbered and in peace. And those times are quickly drawing to an end. And in these times, peace is certainly an illusion. And as the chains grow tighter, our ability to slip those chains increase incrementally with every passing moment. Inaction is no longer an option. It's time to raise our voices like a cacophony of thunder and lightning and tell the masters no more. And this is Nighthawk, and I say, for myself, no more. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, because the freedom is slipping away.
Mainlining fake news, believing globalist lies, trusting celebrity instructions, then you are addicted to our own destruction. Here's an expert on original source true history, your host, the Rebel Madman, Mike Gaddy.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to Addicted to Your Own Destruction here on the ninth day of May in the year of 2021, the second year of total and complete government tyranny and oppression. They've been working up to this for quite some time, and they have kind of perfected their game lately, but they're meeting a little bit of resistance with a little bit of rejection of their wonderful vaccine. But they are moving in the economic field to make sure that we're all completely dominated. We've got a fake attack on a oil pipeline, which is going to create a rapid rise in fuel prices here, which is, I promise you, planned. Because one of the things I learned 40 years ago, if the government tells you something, 99.9% chance of the time, it's a lie. And by the government, I mean both the government and their sycophants in the media. Don't forget what Casey said. We will know our disinformation program is complete when everything the American public believes is false. And that's about true right now. They've reached that moment of perfection to where almost everything they say is a lie. So here we are. We're working towards, towards what? What are we actually working towards? Because it's going to take a good number of people to just absolutely say not no, but hell no to this government before any progress is made. Sure, there's going to be pockets of us who are just going to say no, but how is that going to be dealt with? That is one of the interesting things as we move forward. But let's go back to another period in history. And I have with me tonight my good friend Darrell Wayne from down there in Alabama. Got my other good friend out in Nevada, Robert Hudson. We are going to kind of jump into a conversation about Reconstruction in the South. And we've covered that for a couple of weeks now, but it is a subject that could take months to effectively line out so that most people might understand it. But anyway, the first thing I would like to do is to invite all you folks to step up and help us at freedomslips.com, at Revolution Radio, to help us keep this bastion of free speech moving along. Go to the website, freedomslips.com. There's several ways that you can make a donation. You can find a link to mail in a donation if you would. But I didn't realize in many ways the just how important this was, although I knew it was important. But yesterday we had my good friend from Salt Lake City, Utah on, and Dale had been in broadcast talk radio for about 15 years. And he finally got to where his truth was upsetting too many people, so they had to move him off so they could propagate the proper lies. But he made the comment after being on the program yesterday on Dave Scorpio's show that, along with Darrell and Giuseppe and Chris Weinert and myself, and he commented about the level of what we were saying and what we covered, and the fact that in all of his years, as he referred to his terrestrial radio career, that he had never heard the depth of the conversation that we had yesterday. And so I certainly appreciate that, and I give all of the credit to that to the other people on the show. It certainly wasn't me doing it. But anyway, here we are today, and we're about to jump into Reconstruction again. But I first, let's check with my fellow co-host here and see how they're doing. Darrell, how are you doing down there in Alabama?
Well, good afternoon, Mike and everybody. We're doing good here so far. We do have some rain showers approaching us. I hope I don't lose my signal. And looking forward to being with Robert and you today. And, you know, the topic of Reconstruction is as pertinent now as it was, you know, in the 1868. It's a target-rich environment with a lot of information to mine to bring forward to today. So,
oh well, thank you, my friend. And Robert, what's the word out there in good old Nevada?
It's 70 degrees. A few clouds in the sky, but pretty sunny. It's a very beautiful day, a great day for discussion.
Well, it's always great to have you with us, Robert. Darrell, got a question for you, my friend. What aspect of Reconstruction, and you and I have had many conversations on this subject, what part of Reconstruction would you like to cover today, my friend?
Well, I find the education, the re-education of not only the grown-ups but the children very interesting, of course, and I also find it inseparable with how the churches and the doctrines in those churches and the people that brought forward those new doctrines were critical to bringing about a new society. And then I'm really very interested in how the reconstruction of bringing in the civil law and incrementally applying it to not only the free black 14th Amendment citizens became a new class of political status, but how that was morphed into taking in and encompassing all the black and the white citizens. So I appreciate the question. I'm a little torn. Maybe we can kind of hit on all those a little bit, or bring them to bear. I don't know how you separate them, you know. What are you thinking, Robert?
I definitely want to hear that, but I also want to hear Mr. Gaddy talk about Lincoln and the Greenbacks, because when I was last here two Sundays ago, I was under the impression that Greenbacks didn't make their entree until 1865. According to Professor Gaddy, that's incorrect. In fact, they were introduced much earlier, like 61 or 62. And then also I want to hear about how Lincoln may have had a turnabout or a pang of conscience maybe after Richmond, such that he wanted to bring about the end of the war and bring it to a close as soon as possible.
Okay. Well, the first thing I would like to do, I want to cover all of those in the time that we have allotted today, but I'm going to posit something for you two gentlemen, and I would like your comments on it. I would say that Reconstruction began in the North about 3 years before it began in the South. So what would your comment be to that, DW? Would you agree, disagree? If so, which way, why?
Well, it's a fascinating posit. Politically, I can see where you would make that argument as they ramped up the angst and the social conversation and the discord, bringing about controversy. From a media point of view, that being the newspapers and pamphlets, they were definitely doing it. I'd like to hear your thoughts on in more depth on specifics on some of that, though. That's intriguing.
All right, Robert, what are your thoughts on the fact that Lincoln and the Radical Republicans began Reconstruction in the North at least 2 years prior to the defeat of the South?
That's an interesting subject, one that I've never thought about, because I would have thought Reconstruction was primarily a Southern thing. What would he have been reconstructing up North?
Well, he was reconstructing the form of government, and he was reconstructing what was acceptable. And if it hadn't have been for the war, when Lincoln sends General Benjamin Butler into Maryland to arrest the legislature to make sure that Maryland did not secede from the Union. Was that not a form of Reconstruction? Because what in the Constitution gave the president the right to send the military into any state and arrest the legislature without due process, without cause, for any other reason other than he said so?
So it wouldn't have given him that purview to do that. So, no.
Okay, well, let's look.
Hold on a minute.
Okay.
Hold on a minute. I mean, that's a great question. That's a great question, but and I may be pushing this, but would that plausibly fall under the necessary and proper clause?
Well, the problem is that the necessary and proper clause gave that necessary and proper implied powers to Congress, not to the president.
Mm-hmm. Good point.
So he sent in Butler. Butler arrests the legislature of the state. There's nothing in the Constitution which allows that to happen, even under necessary and proper. But I'm sure that you could get a judge to rule that way. But he arrested the legislature and the mayor of Baltimore, put them all in prison, and to ensure that the legislature did not vote to secede. All right. Then on the other side of the coin, he sends the military into Missouri to stop secession as well. And Missouri got to be a really ironic thing, because if you talk to people now, most people would tell you Missouri did not secede, but Missouri did secede.
Michael, go ahead. Wasn't that part of the Missouri Compromise?
No, in 1857, the Supreme Court had ruled the Missouri Compromise unconstitutional in order to put Dred Scott back as a slave.
Mm.
Okay.
Good point.
So the Missouri deal was he sent in, I believe it was General Kirk from St. Louis, and sent them into, and they were going into Missouri to do the same thing with the legislature that he had done in Maryland. So he was trying to close two doors on the Confederacy as quickly as possible, because there was strong Southern sentiment in Kentucky, because Kentucky was inhabited mostly by Virginians. So he and relatives of people who were still in Virginia. So it was a touchy situation for him, and he knew he had to do something with Missouri just as well. So he sent in the Union Army. And ironically, and this is very seldom ever talked about, when he sent in the Union Army, of course, John C. Fremont was one of his generals. Well, the Union Army goes into Maryland, and one of the first things John C. Fremont does is he outlaws slavery. And he says, all slaves are free in the state of Missouri. Well, Lincoln immediately countermanded his order.
Sure he did.
So if the war was to free the slaves, why did Lincoln prohibit a Union general from freeing the slaves?
Excellent question.
But the point of it is, again, getting back to the legislature hears that they're coming to be arrested. They've sent Union forces in, so they start retreating towards Arkansas. And so they stopped long enough, the legislature, with a quorum and with the governor, to vote to secede from the United States, which they promptly did. That is documented. I have documented proof of that. They actually seceded, and then they actually took their government into the Missouri state government, into Arkansas, and eventually into Texas, where the government of Missouri actually sat in session in the state of Texas. There's a good trivia question for you, gentlemen. Then we have the point, we have those two things that happened, and that's Reconstruction, because you've reconstructed a government, you've constructed a government that will allow you to do those totally unconstitutional things because you are at war. And there was no provision in the Constitution to allow Lincoln to do any of that. There was also nothing in the Constitution that allowed Lincoln to shut down over 300 newspapers. There was also no provision in the Constitution for Lincoln to order the arrest of a congressman from Ohio by the name of Vallandigham and have him deported out of the country. So it's my posit. Pardon me?
Where did he send him to?
Canada.
Oh, wow. Was he a Canadian guy or just?
No, he was from Ohio.
Oh, we just sent him to Canada, just said, get out and go to Canada.
Okay, yeah, you can't stand on the floor of the House of Representatives and talk the Constitution and say that the president is violating constitutional rights because he will have you arrested and have you deported.
And he did.
I think Vallandigham might have initially went to the South, but he ended up in Canada somehow, if I'm not mistaken. So Lincoln had begun a reconstruction of the North at the very beginning of the war. So the Reconstruction, they had changed the government. They had reconstructed the government under the Constitution. And again, people, I will remind you, there was nothing in the Constitution to prohibit. They said you can't do it, but there's no enforcement mechanism placed in that Constitution that would allow the people to stop Lincoln from doing exactly what he was doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, Michael, if I might have a question or an observation here, the Southern states are they not completely aware of these initial actions by Abraham Lincoln prior to Fort Sumter?
Absolutely.
Are they not completely factoring these unconstitutional, extra constitutional acts into their decision to actually remain in the Constitution, which was the Confederation, was the constitutional party, politically and geographically. That just really hit me. They were seeing what was going to be imposed upon them.
Well, absolutely. I don't know how you could have. Seen it any other way. But Missouri, like four other Southern states, which was Virginia, North Carolina, Tennessee, and Arkansas, had voted to remain in the Union initially when the other seven Southern states had seceded. Missouri voted to remain in the Union, but then refused Lincoln's call to arms. So Governor Claiborne, when Lincoln said on April 15th, ordered the states to provide military to invade the South, again, totally unconstitutional. He had no constitutional right to do any of this. So he does it. And so here is what Governor Claiborne Jackson had to say, what he sent to Abraham Lincoln in Washington upon the demand that he provide troops from Missouri. He said, and I quote, "Your dispatch of the 15th instant, making a call on Missouri for four regiments of men for immediate service, has been received. There can be, I apprehend, no doubt but that the men are intended to form a part of the president's army to make war on the people of the seceded states. Your requisition, in my judgment, is illegal, unconstitutional, and revolutionary in its object. Inhumane, diabolical, and cannot be complied with. Not one man will Missouri furnish to carry on such an unholy crusade." Unquote. So upon receipt of this letter, Lincoln immediately orders the military to invade Missouri.
Equally unconstitutional.
Exactly. So he orders an unconstitutional military invasion and takeover of Missouri. Governor Jackson activated the Missouri State Guard in his state's defense. The guard was placed under the command of Sterling Price, himself a former Missouri governor. The Union Army of Invasion consisted of mostly Germans from the east, placed under the command of General Lyons. I said Lane. I'm sorry. It was Lyons, who was stationed in St. Louis at the time. Lyons was ordered to oust Governor Jackson and the duly elected legislature from the Capitol and to occupy the state. Union forces took over Jefferson City at Bayonet Point, Jackson and the legislature escaping ahead of the invaders. They traveled along with Price and the State Guard. Lincoln appointed a temporary governor, Hamilton Rowan Gamble. So he's appointing governors. There is nothing in the Constitution that allows the president to appoint a governor.
Nope.
So following several...
Michael,
go ahead.
Well, what you're describing and laying out here is the United States attacking America with foreign Prussian Hessian mercenaries.
Well, what if I were to posit there was no United States at that time?
No, there wasn't. There wasn't. Because half of them left.
But we had a tyrant, an absolute tyrant. And he was exercising powers of a king. There is no other explanation.
Yeah, agreed.
Because the legislature, the U.S. Congress, did not convene until July. He's doing all of this in April and May. So he did all of this. Well, when the Congress comes in, because the Southerners have left with all of their representatives, of course, they approve what Lincoln has done. So following several skirmishes between the Missouri State Guard and the Union Army invaders, there ensued the Battle of Wilson's Creek near Springfield, Missouri, or as the people of the South prefer to call it, the Battle of Oak Hills. General Lyons was killed and the Union Army was defeated. It was the first major battle of the war west of the Mississippi River. Following that battle, Jackson and the state legislature convened near Carthage, Missouri, and submitted an act of secession from the Union. And here is the act of secession. It's not that long. I will read it. Whereas the government of the United States in the possession and under the control of the sectional party has wantonly violated the compact originally made between said government and the state of Missouri by invading with hostile armies the soil of our state, attacking and making prisoners of the militia while legally assembled under the state laws, forcibly occupying the state capital and attempting through the instrumentality of domestic traitors to usurp the state government, seizing and destroying private property and murdering with fiendish malignity peaceable citizens, men, women, and children, together with other acts of atrocity, indicating a deep-seated hostility toward the people of Missouri and their institutions. And whereas the present administration of the government of the United States has utterly ignored the Constitution, subverted the government as constructed and intended by its makers, and established a despotic and an arbitrary power instead thereof, now, therefore, be it enacted by the General Assembly of the State of Missouri that all political ties of every character now existing between the government of the United States of America and the people and the government of the State of Missouri are hereby dissolved, and the State of Missouri resuming the sovereignty granted by compact to the said United States upon admission of said state into the Federal Union, does again take its place as a free and independent republic amongst the nations of the earth. This act to take effect and be in force from and after its passage, passed by the Missouri State Senate on October 28, 1861, passed by the Missouri State House of Representatives on October 30th, 1861, signed into effect by Governor Claiborne Fox Jackson, October 31st, 1861. Now, were either of you gentlemen ever taught this in school?
No, sir. Never.
Well, now, did they just forget it, guys, or was this intentional?
Intentional. They never knew it.
Well, following its announced secession from the Union, Missouri applied for admission to the Confederate States of Union, Confederate States of America, and was admitted into the Confederate States by an act of her Congress during November 1861 as the 12th state in the Confederate States and as the 12th star in her various flags. But if you talk to historians today, the majority of them, and ask them, did Missouri secede, they will tell you no. But the National Archives and the Library of Congress prove unequivocally that they are false and they are categorically wrong. Sterling Price took the State Guard into Arkansas, where they were merged into the regular Confederate Army, and he was commissioned a Brigadier General. Governor Jackson died during the war in Little Rock, and the Lieutenant Governor took the legislature to Marshall, Texas, where he continued to conduct the affairs of state until the war's end. To this day, Marshall, Texas brags that it is the only city in America to host another state's government.
Wow.
So, You know, we go back to that wonderful Marxist historian, Clinton Rossiter, and we think about the statement he made that has to be one of the most absolute asinine statements I've ever heard made by any intelligent person in history, when he said that Lincoln had to destroy the Constitution in order to preserve it.
That is asinine.
So, D.W., your thoughts, my friend?
Wow, there's a lot there. Well, let's back up a little bit. So when Lincoln attacks Baltimore and Maryland, he's establishing a precedent. And that's a very compelling argument for Reconstruction right there. So, I mean, so we're not equivocating here. The act of destruction is a part of Reconstruction. And that goes directly to the asinine statement of that historian you just said, that is that after you've destroyed the Constitution, you when you reconstruct it, it's not the same thing that it was prior to its destruction. Okay, that's an impossibility. So this is just a very clever play on words to get around. We have to create something new while still maintaining the premise, the illusion that we're preserving something. Nothing was to be preserved. And a whole new thing was to be reconstructed. Now, the 300 newspapers that were shut down and the people that were the man that was who was that guy that was shipped off? He was who was that guy you were talking about? The
congressman?
Yeah, Ohio.
Yeah. Congressman Vallon Bigham.
That's the original. Yes.
Vallandigham.
Yeah. That's an example of the original cancel culture. Okay, that's cancel culture right there. And the 300 newspapers being shut down, that's like shutting down the internet, isn't it, Michael? So
very much so.
Good analogy. Yeah.
Yeah. So And the timeline on this is that he's performing these acts with the newspapers in Maryland and the Ohio gentleman from Ohio. Is this prior to April 12th at Fort Sumter?
No, this is afterwards.
Oh, okay. Well, it's. I'm just never at a loss of amazement of just how many of the important details that were left out of the real story in order to make the false story palatable to the minds of all the generations that came afterwards. It's amazing.
Well, exactly. I'm looking at some official stuff here. It says that in 1863, Clement Vallandigham, a congressman from Ohio, was convicted at an army court-martial. Now, he wasn't in the army. He was convicted at an army court-martial of opposing the war. So they had made opposing the war in the North a felonious act.
Make it up as you go along.
Exactly. And he was originally exiled to the Confederacy. And he was from Lebanon.
Okay.
He was from Lebanon, Ohio.
So undeniably, what's the supposed authorities that Abraham Lincoln's operating under at this time, the pretense anyway, is martial law. Straight up. It's just martial law. Period. Wouldn't it have to be?
Well, he ran into a little trouble there because the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Roger Taney said that he could not, and they gave an official ruling that Lincoln did not have the power to install martial law, only the Congress did. And so Lincoln ordered an arrest warrant for the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court.
Was he arrested?
No, fortunately, the U.S. Marshals Service refused to serve the warrant.
Good. At least somebody had a brain.
So where in the Constitution, with all of our balance of powers and all of this other stuff, does it give the president the right to arrest the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court?
Same place we get the power through our newspapers.
When... Good one, Robert. When was when were the original Emergency Powers Act enacted?
1962.
That's a long way from 1861.
Just 100 years.
He was ahead of his time. Yeah.
Well, now let's stop and think about this. We have just talked about, and he put thousands of people in prison in the North without due process.
Yeah.
And if you want to study each one of those cases, there is a great book that's called The American Bastille. I don't know how hard that would be to find anymore. Robert, if you have the ability, see if that book is still available. The American Bastille. But it gives very good stories of each of the people. Well, not all of them, because he put some thousands in prison. But the biggest cases, it fully illustrates that he was acting as a despotic king. Now, considering all of these things, there's a couple of questions. Considering all of these things we have just pointed out about Abraham Lincoln, why would today's Republican Party have a celebration every year called the Lincoln Day Dinner?
Yeah, it is on Amazon by John A. Marshall.
Yep. So they have a Lincoln Day Dinner. Now let's drop back to the 2016 election, guys. You know, just 5 years in our rearview mirror here, a little less than 5 years. So we've got a 2016 election. And during that election cycle, Hillary Rodham Clinton, a Democratic candidate for president, was asked, who is your favorite president? And if you were president, who would you most fashion your administration after? And she said, sorry, Bill, but it would be Abraham Lincoln. Okay, then later in Detroit, Michigan, the other candidate from the Republican Party, Donald Trump, made the statement of he was proud to be the delegate, the nominee for the party of Lincoln, and that he intended to bring back the principles of the party of Lincoln, both to the United States and to the Republican Party.
Man, I remember that. That gives me chills.
So here is what you have when you end up, and I have to go back to Hosea 4:6. My people are destroyed for a lack of knowledge, and they have rejected knowledge. So here's that knowledge that's out there about Abraham Lincoln, and yet in the previous election, 2016, we've got both candidates wanting a government like Abraham Lincoln's. And the people on both sides go, yay, let's elect these people.
Yep.
Well, I think you just answered, one of your own questions, one of your own rhetorical questions there, Michael, in that if the people, particularly the ones that call themselves conservatives, had a full appreciation of what Lincoln and who Lincoln was, and they may not have been as so receptive to that message by Donald Trump. They might have had a different perspective on what those principles were. So that's the beautiful part about education or indoctrination and misinformation, is that you can twist the narrative and torture it to reflect the values and goals that you want to bring forward. And this is this is a perfect example of it. So, yeah.
Donald Trump was a breath of fresh air. A bad breath of fresh air.
Oh, okay. Oh, guys, I'm going to have to bring up a quote here from a gentleman by the name of Albert Camus, C-A-M-U-S, and he is a very interesting character in history. But here I think his quote is most applicable. And he says that the evil that is in this world almost always comes of ignorance, and good intentions may do as much harm as malevolence if they lack understanding.
Agreed. Agreed. Well, they say that the road to hell is paved with good intention.
Oh, I'm sure. But what the PSYOP, the massive PSYOP, has been able to do in this country is to convince people that they split along political party lines when both parties, as was proved by Hillary Rodham Clinton and Donald Trump, both parties want the same damn thing.
Yeah. Total destruction of America. And they use different methodologies, but they're getting there the same way.
Yeah, that's... I think I wrote something years ago, and I said, here is the prayer of the American voter. And quote, and this is mine. This came from me. So if you want to blame somebody, it's mine. So here is the prayer of the American voter. Please help me. For decades now, I have voted for the lesser of two evils, and now the resulting evil is destroying everything I hold dear. Would everyone please ratify an amendment to our Constitution which would enable me to protect myself and those I care about from my own ignorance and cowardice? Unquote. Am I being too hard? Being too hard on the American voter, guys?
No, I think you're being spot on. And the lesser two evils is laughable because it's still legal.
Yes, and of course, here, let me get this quote directly from Mr. Trump. He says, becoming the nominee of the party of Abraham Lincoln, a lot of people don't realize that Abraham Lincoln, the great Abraham Lincoln, was a Republican, has been the greatest honor of my life. It is on his legacy that I hope to build the future of the party, but more importantly, the future of this country and this community. Unquote.
He's building something, all right.
So Donald Trump told the people back in 2016 that he was going to be as corrupt and as tyrannical as Abraham Lincoln, and he thought that was a good thing. And so did his opponent, the Wicked Witch of the East.
Wicked Witch of the East.
Easy, Robert. Don't hurt yourself. So, guys, here's the question. Just how stupid are we as a country?
Is that a question?
Oh,
yes. That's not a rhetorical question. I'm searching for an answer.
What's the over and under?
Well, they're stupid enough to participate in their own abuse, and
Daryl. Oh,
Mike. He said he was getting some storms and he might drop off. So, Robert, we'll just jump in here and do the best we can.
Okay, Susie's still there. Interesting. Yeah, I don't know what to say now. I don't know what to say anymore. I'm damn near speechless. I just don't know what to say.
Well, can a people of a country this damn ignorant, can they ever hope for freedom?
They can hope for it.
Well, I mean, considering there's, this goes back to the good old redhead from Virginia, Thomas Jefferson, when he said, we get the government we deserve.
Yeah. And I think that's where we are. We're getting just what they deserve. We deserve. Yeah, Daryl dropped off.
Yeah, I see that. So, yeah, well, he told me ahead of time they were expecting some heavy thunderstorms, and he usually doesn't fare well with his internet in these thunderstorms. So, Robert, would you say then that, Lincoln started Reconstruction of the U.S. government and started it with the northern states before he started with the southern states?
Based on the past 45 minutes, I would say yes. On the multiple examples you just gave, yes. Oh, by the way, I didn't get this in. I don't know if you're aware of this or not, Michael, but there is a part of downtown Vegas that is named Fremont. And I'm thinking it's after the general that you talked about from the Union.
That would be correct. Yeah, I've been on Fremont Street. I've been there on multiple occasions. Used to take German and French tourists down there on a tour of Vegas. And, all of the, what they have, the big skylights and, like fireworks and what have you.
Yeah, and you can do all sorts of drinking and other mischief there as well, which goes on there pretty much nightly.
So if we look at this Reconstruction, and then we see that then, and here's another posit I want to throw out there, Robert, and I want to see what you think of it. So the war is over. The South has surrendered, and then I want to get to your questions you brought up earlier. But the South has surrendered, and suddenly they bring the South brings in their delegates to the U.S. Congress long enough to ratify, or they bring in their state legislatures long enough to ratify the 13th Amendment to abolish slavery. Okay, so they get that done. And then they proposed the 14th Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
And the southern states reject it unanimously.
Sure they did.
So then the government, and here's what happened. The government then comes up with the Reconstruction Act of 1867, and they do something completely and totally unconstitutional. They kick the 10 southern states out of the Union. And they put them under military dictatorship in 5 separate regions of 2 states each. So they are completely controlled by the U.S. military. The U.S. military decides who can vote, who can't. All trials, regardless of the crime, are held by military and not the states. And the states are told, hey, look, if you guys want to come back in to the Union, one, you have to ratify the 14th Amendment, and two, you have to write a state constitution and submit it to the federal government for approval. Now, if you send in a constitution that the federal government doesn't approve, then you will not be allowed back in as a state. So there is nothing whatsoever anywhere in the Constitution that allows the federal government to kick the states out of the Union and then put conditions upon their reentry. There's nothing there. There was nothing in the Articles of Confederation. There was nothing in the Constitution.
No.
So. Oh, my goodness. Let me see if I can bring Dave in here. Hey, Dave.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Hi, fair to Midland.
David.
How you doing?
Well, I'm hanging in there, man. I'm doing okay.
Okay. All righty. Well, we had to start without you. Apologize for that.
Oh, no, I apologize. I'm sorry. The power went out here for a while. I got had a harsh rainstorm, but it came back on, so I'm good now.
Well, great. I think we have lost Daryl due to a rainstorm in Alabama.
Oh, so, wow. We're dropping like flies out here, Mike.
Yeah. This rainstorm's taking care of all of us. But what we were discussing, Dave, to bring you up to speed, we're talking about Reconstruction, and I made the posit that Lincoln began Reconstruction in the North in 1861, as soon as he was installed as president. And he began a Reconstruction effort, including taking over the state governments of Maryland and Missouri. And we went into some detail on that, and I'm not going to bore the listeners with a rendition of that, but that was just my posit that Reconstruction began under Lincoln in the North, and the South came along as second. But Robert, in the beginning, Robert had a couple of questions. I want to attempt to try to answer those questions now. Robert, please.
Yeah, I was under the impression that, first off, that the greenbacks that Lincoln started didn't come into play until after the Civil War ended, and you shot me down immediately on that. And the other thing is, I figured Lincoln was bad from start to finish, but you shot me down on that with the deal at Richmond. So those are my two positions.
Okay. Well, the first one, what happened is Lincoln believes that this war is going to last 90 days max. And so the first drafting of soldiers was for 90 days. And they asked for 90-day enlistments as well. So they had people coming in for 90 days. But suddenly Lincoln finds out he's maybe bitten off a bit more than he can chew. Because then they get their butts handed to them at the Battle of First Manassas. And they're driven back into the city. And then there's setback after setback. 1862 was a tough year for the Union Army, especially in the Shenandoah Valley, where Stonewall Jackson was going up against Fremont, Shields, and Banks, the three generals, and they had about 100,000 men under their command, and Stonewall had somewhere between 30,000 to 35,000 max at any one given time, and Stonewall was going up and down the Shenandoah Valley just kicking ass and taking names. And it got so perilous in Washington, D.C., that they actually pulled up the planks on the bridges across the Potomac River because they was afraid Stonewall was going to come marching into Washington, D.C. and take the place over.
Too bad he didn't.
So they get into 1862, and Lincoln goes to Salmon P. Chase, his Secretary of Treasury, and he says, look, we've got to have some money if we're going to continue this war. We've got to have some money. And so Chase goes to the international bankers and he says, hey, guys, we need to borrow some money. And the international banker says, no problem. We've got you covered, baby. What do you need? We'll let you have it at, somewhere between 30% and 40% interest.
Jeez.
So Lincoln says, no, we're not going to do that. So he writes a letter to a friend in Texas, someone he had come in contact with in his lawyer capacity. So he writes a letter and he says, I can't figure out what to do. And so this gentleman down in Texas says, well, just issue money on the faith and credit of the United States. He said, therefore, you don't have to pay interest on it to anybody. You create the money and just let the money circulate and create your own money. And so Lincoln and Salmon P. Chase did, and they called it the greenback. And so immediately immediately the international bankers start looking at this and they say, oh man, we can't allow this to happen. There is no way that we can allow this to continue. So how are we going? What are we going to do? We've got to do something. So they then decided to do the good old traditional trick and buy a politician. So they were able to purchase Salmon P. Chase, is my belief, but and probably along with others as well. And they sent, like, goodness, I keep getting badgered here. So they send about $500,000 to Salmon P. Chase, and Salmon P. Chase sets about buying as many politicians as needed to pass to make the greenbacks no good. And so they are able to do so. And but the first thing that happens is that the bankers issue what is called the hazard circular. And I think we've talked about that before. And they send the hazard, they send the hazard circular to the American banks. Well, we're getting close here to the top of the hour, and I'm not going to jump into this at this time. DW, you back with us, my friend?
Yeah, thanks for bringing me back in. We had a little thunderstorm here, and I dropped out.
All right, so, and we've got we've got our good friend Dave Scorpio back with us as well.
Yeah, I had the same problem, Daryl.
That's great.
And you guys aren't exactly neighbors, are you?
No, not yet. Yeah, not yet. Anyway, so yeah, you were. I dropped off when I was. You were. I was trying to answer your question about how stupid the American people were, and I said, "Well, is it possible that they're so stupid that they'll participate in their own abuse, in their own abuse, and fund it, and be proud of it? Can they be that stupid?" Yeah.
All right, guys, we'll be back on the flip side. Thanks, everyone.
Sir.
You're listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. We'll be right back after this message.
But that doesn't mean that they're telling the truth as opposed to fiction.
And Genesis chapter 6, verse 4, and there were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came and unto the daughters of men, indicating that there were giants before the Nephilim.
And sons of God, plural. They weren't talking about Jesus coming down.
No, that's right. Yeah.
I'm Steve Crawford, host of Factor Theory Live. Join me every Sunday night from 10 p.m. till midnight Eastern Standard Time on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Check it out.
Transcending time and space, let us take you to the place inside your mind where thoughts divide and mysteries unwind. Join us every Monday evening right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, and you will catch The Fenton Perspective with our great host, Lorian Fenton. Come listen in as she shares her amazing stories from the past to present, along with all of her guest secrets to the future. That's The Fenton Perspective every Monday evening right here from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, only on Revolution Radio. Oh, and you don't need to expect
us.
We're already here.
Galactic Interstellar Council on Revolution Radio Studio A, Fridays at 2 p.m. Eastern. Join us as we traverse the starseed paradigm, as expressed in the time-space continuum that we know as the divine expression of love and light. integrating this conscious unity into the galactic paradigm. So welcome all, both terrestrial beings and galactic beings as one. So be it. You're listening to Revolution Radio.
If you think for one second that the Capitol will ever treat us fairly, you are lying to yourselves. Because we know who they are and what they do. This is what they do, and we must fight back. You can torture us and bomb us. Fire is catching. And if we burn, you burn with us.
Good evening.
Are you awake yet? I hope. We've tried and we've tried for years and years to use passive resistance and loud voices to make a change. That time is over. Your governments around the world have no other goal than to decimate your entire existence at the hands of the bankers and the elites. The war is coming, and it's your choice to decide if you want to be a warrior or a victim. Denial is not a choice anymore. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet, not giving up. Revolution Radio. Thanks for listening while we take that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And now we're going to get back to your host.
Well, welcome back, everyone, to Addicted to Your Own Destruction. And we start our second hour with a full panel. We've got our producer from down south of the equator, Dave Scorpio. We have Daryl Wayne from Alabama. Both of these two have just survived a thunderstorm, which treated their internet connection very badly. And then we have our good friend from out there in Reno, Nevada, Mr. Robert Hudson, the man with the famous laugh. And I am the Rebel Madman, and we are here discussing Reconstruction, and did Reconstruction actually occur in the North? Was the entire government reconstructed, and did the reconstructed Northern government then reconstruct the Southern government in its image? Daryl, you were kind of kicked off there when you were answering a question. Do you want to continue, my friend?
Well, I mean, I thought it was a really good question that you asked about how stupid the American people were, and or maybe that's United States citizens. Is there a difference? I think so. And my comment was that they were stupid enough to participate and fund their own abuse, and then be proud of. And this is mentality and lack of knowledge has left us in a state of artificial reality where up is down and down is up and forward is backwards. And I guess that's okay. I mean, that's where we've come to at this point. And, you know, these historical interventions are very important, at the very least, for my understanding of the present. So I appreciate what you're doing, Mike, and what you bring to the table and help everybody to reorganize their perspective. So
Well, I appreciate that. Dave, you've kind of caught on to the tail end here as you came in. We were talking about did Abraham Lincoln reconstruct the North first before they began the reconstruction of the South? Do you have any thoughts on that? Not hearing our first 45 minutes of discussion.
Well, Mike, that's a fascinating concept, and it would seem to me that really, you know, if this is correct, that it was essentially a power grab, you know, away from the states to the federal government, consolidating power. Would you say that's correct?
Yes, it was absolutely a consolidation of power, but there was nothing in the Constitution to prevent it.
Ah, right. Okay. And I had a question, you know, a minute ago, before we reached the top of the hour, you had said that Lincoln believed that the Civil War was going to last for 90 days. Do you think he really believed that? Or was that just sort of a trick to engage people to get the war started? Or possibly were advisors telling him that to trick Lincoln? It sounds, you know, it's hard to believe somebody actually would think that the war would only last 90 days. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I've got quite a few thoughts on it, and I try to look at it from the viewpoint, had I been sitting in the chair in the White House in 1861, just being inaugurated, I would look to the industrial North, and I would say, look, we've got all of the ships, we've got all of the manufacturers, we've got the ironworks. Now, there was one ironwork in Richmond, Virginia, but the majority of the ironworks were in the North. The majority of the railroad systems were in the North. The North had a free flow of immigrants coming through in New York. And you look down at the South and you go, hey, what do we got down there? Well, you know, gosh, the majority of folks in New York, the majority of the folks in South Carolina are Black. There is a great Black population in the South. You know, if I say, hey, you guys are all free, they're all going to come. They're all going to turn against their owners. They're going to turn against the plantation. They're going to turn against the people. We're going to have, you know, all of these wonderful things that we're going to have. So I can see where, and we've got the Navy. The South doesn't have a Navy. We can blockade ports. They can't get supplies in and out. I could see where Lincoln would think it might be over in 90 days. But you also make the point, Dave, that that may have been a strategic move to try to get more people to rush in to help. But I could see a person sitting there with the idea that, hey, we've got everything on our side. They've got nothing. Robert, you got any thoughts on that?
Yeah. My thought is, what's my thought? The war shouldn't have been fought at all because the North was kind of in the catbird seat, as you just mentioned. They had all the resources. So why did they need to go to war at all? Really, they didn't. They just wanted power. Save for that, there really was no reason. They had everything. They held all the cards from my perspective, other than, you know, raw materials like cotton and such. They didn't have that, but they had the means to with which to make cotton into garments and fabrics and such. So why not just let bygones be bygones and figure out how to get along? But I guess that was too hard. The easy route for them to take was just go to war.
Well, what if the motive behind the war from the very beginning was to completely reconstruct the government of the United States?
That too. Yeah. He clearly was a socialist and wanted socialism to be the word of the day. So he kind of got his way on that, or at least laid the groundwork for it to become the word of the day. So, yeah, I can see that.
Well, D.W., what's your thoughts on the subject, sir?
Well, thanks for asking. It dawned on me here that when you were discussing the idea that Lincoln thought this might only be a 90-day operation, and that he was trying to, or whoever the media was, and the people that were facilitating this, were trying to induce the common man of the North to come into this and flood in, to use your words. I find it fascinating that men of that time would, in large numbers, would attack their fellow countrymen, or at this time, the Confederate, enlist to attack them when there was no possibility of the South invading the North. That wasn't even in any of the any aspect of the intent of the South to invade the North. Their position was a completely different basis for the South was all about protecting itself, and the North was about inserting itself, and that the common man would voluntarily join in to attack people that were actually of no personal threat to them. And then I see that there's a pattern of this all the way through, subsequently all the way through the 19th century. And that's what I find intriguing. Lincoln would have been happy with a guy like LBJ and McNamara working for him, wouldn't he?
Oh, absolutely. No doubt. Dave, to your point and the question, and the evidence is clear here that can be found with a due diligent search of original source documents, is that Stonewall Jackson went to Jefferson Davis and he said, "Look, I have a proposal." He said, "There is no way, Mr. President, that the South can win a prolonged war. We can, if the war is dragged out, we do not have the resources. We don't have the railroads. We don't have the shipping. We don't have everything we need. And if we are to win this war, we must do it quickly and decisively." And Stonewall Jackson laid out a plan of invading Maryland and cutting off Washington, D.C. from the rest of the North. And he believed that that would bring about a quick end to the war, and that was the South's only military chance at victory. Well, that was rejected, D.W., because of what you said just a minute ago. It was rejected because Jefferson Davis said, "I do not want this to be a war of Southern invasion into the North. I want this to be strictly a defensive war. I want us to just defend ourselves, to not be the aggressors." Well, while that may have been a noble thing to do, they were already under attack. So, in my idea, once they were under attack, once they had sent forces into Missouri, into Maryland, they had sent forces into Virginia, they had sent forces into Kentucky. Once those things had happened, I believe the non-aggression pact went out the window. But, of course, I wasn't Jefferson Davis. And I do believe that Jackson was exactly right, because he thought in the beginning of the war that there was a lot of sympathy in places like Maryland for the South, that an invasion there, because you have to remember that when they had to ship troops through Maryland from Pennsylvania to get to Washington, D.C., and that was one of the first big battles of the war, is when the people in Maryland started firing on the train with the Union troops in it. So there was strong Southern support in Maryland. And especially these people had just seen the U.S. military come in and arrest their legislature and the mayor of Baltimore and put them in prison. These were not a happy people.
No, they wouldn't have been. Do you think Jeff Davis was influenced on that deal by Benjamin, Judith Benjamin, Michael?
Absolutely. I believe that Judah P. Benjamin was the agent of the international bankers, and he was wanting to prolong this war as long as possible, and he certainly didn't want the South to defeat the North. People have asked questions for years, gentlemen, about why didn't England come in on the side of the South? They were the people who were getting a lot of cotton from the South, and they needed it. So why didn't they just simply say, okay, we're coming in to aid the South? Because England then would have gotten, you know, back into influence, back into the United States again in a major way if they would have helped the South. France could have done the same thing. But I believe that the international bankers prevented that because, number one, they wanted to build up the debt of a war, which they most certainly did. They built up a huge debt, and it was taking anywhere from 30 to 40 to 50% of all of the revenue that was coming into this country to pay off that debt in 1865, 1866. So they wanted the debt. They knew that a prolonged war was the best way to realize that debt.
Yeah, I guess they were right on that front, too.
So,
yeah, no doubt.
Yeah, Dave, what... any other thoughts or questions you have on that point?
Well, no, actually, I was going to ask the same question that Robert did. And, I agree with your answer completely. And, you know, the strategy that Stonewall Jackson laid out was absolutely brilliant. It probably would have worked. It's pure genius.
Well, I have no doubt that the chances for the South were tremendously boosted by that maneuver. It certainly would have made a difference because at that time, you know, if you look at it militarily, and most people look at the war politically and you don't look at it militarily, but at that point, you know, there had been some crazy things happen. You know, we had McClellan I don't know if you'd call him incompetent or not, but he certainly was getting his butt handed to him not only... Of course, he wasn't in charge at First Manassas, but then he was at Second Manassas in charge of the army. And then he had the troops that tried to come in the peninsula in Virginia. And Jeb Stuart took his cavalry and rode completely around the Union army early in the war. It was that easy to do. He made a trip all the way around the army and they couldn't stop him. So the Southern army was without a doubt more effective at what they were doing in the early parts of the war, and the battles prove that. I think the battles are prove the fact that they were far superior. But you know you had some idiots like Pierre Gouffetant Toutant Beauregard and his screw up at in Tennessee at Shiloh. Not listening to Forrest, and he should have been listening to Forrest, and he didn't. And so we had those problems. And of course, you had Braxton Bragg, who was a Confederate general, who was a close friend of Jefferson Davis, who was a bumbling idiot. Go ahead.
What's that French guy's name again?
Pierre Gouffetant Toutant Beauregard.
Evil
or fraud. Yeah, PGT Beauregard. Nathan Bedford Forrest tried to get to Beauregard's headquarters at Shiloh on the Tennessee River there. He tried to get to him to tell him, hey, they are bringing in reinforcements. They're coming across the river. If we allow these reinforcements from Rosecrans, if we allow these, they had driven the Union Army right, had their backs at the river. On the first day of, I think it was in April of 62, April 5th, I believe. I could be wrong by a day or two. But anyway, they had driven on the first day, they had driven the Union Army and had their backs against the river. And Rosecrans was coming to reinforce them. And you had Nathan Bedford Forrest, who was riding around trying to find a general with some cojones, who would go ahead and complete the attack and not sit and rest and wait until the next day, because he knew by the next day Rosecrans would have been would have his troops across the river and would be reinforcing the Union Army. And if they would have listened to Forrest, who knows what would have happened if they would have driven the Union Army right into the Tennessee River. So at Pittsburgh Landing. So that was a goof up by Beauregard. And then, of course, at Lookout Mountain and also Seminary Ridge in Tennessee, Beauregard was such an idiot, and also at Stones River. I like the interaction at Stones River in December of 1862 when Bragg took Nathan Bedford Forrest's army and just got him almost completely wiped out, got him decimated. And at the end of the battle, Forrest rides up to Bragg, pulls off his gauntlet, slaps Bragg through the face, and he said, "Sir, should I ever again meet you on the field of battle, I will kill you." So those are some of the fun things about the war that most people don't know. But Forrest was a genius. He was a military genius. And if Forrest would have been allowed to conducted the war on his terms or conducted his part of the war on his terms, there never would have been a march to the sea, I do not believe. But Bragg kept Forrest handicapped in Tennessee over and over and over again. And, because he was a friend of the president, he was kept in position. And now he has a big military base named for him in North Carolina.
So what was Robert Edward Lee doing during all this time?
Well, Robert, I don't make a lot of friends when I talk about Robert E. Lee from a strategic point of view. I think Robert E. Lee was a wonderful man. He was just absolutely moral. You know, he wanted to do everything that was right. He was a good man down to his toes. But strategically, he lacked a lot, in my opinion. He won a huge battle in December of 1862 at Fredericksburg by having the high ground, and he just cut Burnside to pieces as Burnside was marching across the open field. His artillery and his men just cut Burnside to pieces and won the battle without any question. But then later, Lee would fall to the same. He would do the same thing that Burnside did. And he, and especially at Gettysburg, to charge across that open field, marching in formation at Cemetery Ridge, to charge across that open field, what was called Pickett's Charge, have your men charge across that field was absolute murder. And it never should have occurred. Longstreet tried his best to talk Lee out of doing that. Lee got upset at him. When you look at the strategic genius of Nathan Bedford Forrest and Stonewall Jackson, had those two men been in higher positions of authority, I think it would have been a very different outcome.
Why weren't they?
Well, Michael is.
Because they were not of the gentry. The South was doing the same thing that others had done. Stonewall Jackson was not of the gentry. He was not of the upper class. He was not of the wealthy and the well-born. And Nathan Bedford Forrest certainly he was a slave trader, and he was a lumber guy in Memphis, and he was wealthy. But he had no military experience, and I believe he also was not of the gentry. He wasn't of the acceptable upper class. So only the upper class could have the position of generals. And that that cost the South dearly.
Yeah, I guess it
did. Michael, is it safe to say that Robert E. Lee and some of the other generals were fighting with some of the strategies of the Napoleonic period? They had a Napoleonic mentality, because those were the battles that they had studied and brought forward into the Civil War battle strategies. Is that safe to say that?
Oh, absolutely. It is true. But at the Battle of First Manassas, Stonewall Jackson saw two things that had changed the history of warfare. And he saw those two things as soon as the battle began. Within minutes, he saw that there were two changes in technical changes that were going to change the way we fought wars. And he saw that the rifled musket, as opposed to the smoothbore, was tremendously more accurate. And he saw that when you just line up and stand in lines and shoot at each other, that the devastation was going to be huge. So at the Battle of First Manassas, Stonewall ordered his men to get prone and on their knees because he saw that. The second thing that Stonewall saw that was going to change the course of battle was what was called grape shot or canister, which was like a cannon that performed like a shotgun. And instead of just straight lead balls or straight steel balls coming at you, to have them converted to exploding projectiles, which exploded either on the ground or right over your head with all of the shrapnel that was inside, he saw that that was going to change the strategy of warfare too. So he saw right away that you could not do the Napoleonic thing and line up in nice lines and shoot at each other, which today's world is insanity squared.
Well, I think there's an object lesson in this conversation for the present situation we're in here in America. And then that object lesson is that you never win a fight or a war on defense only, if that's your strategy. If your objective is only defense, you can't win. No matter what kind of warfare it is, it can't be won on defense only, as Jefferson Davis's stated objectives were. So,
well, stop and think about the philosophy of Nathan Bedford Forrest, which he said frequently. He said, "If your enemy is about to charge you, charge him first."
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go.
Nathan Bedford Forrest. He was unpredictable.
Well, which made him, if you study military strategy, which I have done at length, and if you look at what happened to Forrest and how he conducted himself when he was outnumbered 4-1 at Bryce's Crossroads, and to be outnumbered 4-1 and kick their ass, and the strategy that he used to do it was just absolutely genius. And no one else in the Southern Army had that genius. And after the war, when William Tecumseh Sherman was asked who was the ablest general that the South had, and Sherman said, well, the ablest, and everybody thought he was going to say Robert E. Lee, Stonewall Jackson, somebody like that. And Stonewall Jackson said, William Tecumseh Sherman said, the ablest, most skilled general that the South had was the devil incarnate himself, Nathan Bedford Forrest.
Yeah. Well, if anybody's actually interested in a wonderful book about Nathan Bedford Forrest, the title of it is "Bust Hell Wide Open" by Samuel Mitchum, and it's a great read. And you'll learn a lot about guerrilla warfare. Mm-hmm. And that's what would have turned the tide for the South was to, militarily and strategically, I would suggest, was to use their superior guerrilla generals in the form of Nathan Bedford Forrest and Jackson. So.
Go ahead, Robert.
Did Forrest use the pincer move when he was outnumbered 4-1?
No, he used, he saw that the Northern Army that was approaching him, he saw that they had cavalry, artillery, and infantry. So he put a group of men up front and charged to take care of the infantry and as best he could to get under the scope of the artillery. So he charged them only with a portion of his men, but he had the rest of his men back farther stationed and ready. So he does the initial charge and he fires up the Union Army. Then he turns his back as to run, and they retreat with the Union cavalry hot on their heels. And when they run into the second line that Forrest has established, their cavalry is cut to pieces. The infantry hears the battle taking place, so the infantry and the artillery rush to get to the sound of the battle, and by the time they get there, they're exhausted. So Forrest kicks their ass. It was brilliant strategy on his part. And that was why he was known as the Wizard of the Saddle.
I think it was a term well earned.
And really something, considering the man had never had a single day of military training. The other thing that is significant is that probably in 1860, Nathan Bedford Forrest was probably a millionaire. And he equipped his first army. He bought the horses, he bought the accoutrements, he bought everything for his first army. And he equipped them, out of his own pocket.
What was his motivation if he was a millionaire? He just didn't want to be pushed around by the North. That's why he joined up to fight?
Well, he didn't believe that the North had the right to tell the South what to do.
Well, he was right on that level.
And, Robert, he had over, I think at the time, he had somewhere between 30 to 40 male slaves. And Forrest told these men, said, "You come, you ride with me. Freedom is yours if we win this thing, or if we lose this thing. Either way, you're free." So a lot of people are unaware of the several very loyal black men that served with Forrest throughout the war.
Well, Michael, I would also suggest that Forrest had something that present day wealthy conservatives don't have, and that's principle. And willing to put it on the line, and those principles I don't see present now. So he was willing to risk it all for his principles, and until that is being done again, it will continue.
All of these stories parallel. Yeah. I think we can draw parallels from history to what is going on today. Dave, yeah. You're kind of being kind of quiet there, buddy. What are your comments?
No, this is a great conversation. I'm just kind of taking it in. Keep going. I'll comment in a minute. This is, I'm just taking notes here, actually, Mike.
Well, I thought one of the funny parts about Shiloh in April of 1862 was when Forrest was, he had gone just past the Indian mounds that were there. And he was watching from the crest of one of the Indian mounds. He was watching as Rosecrans' troops were arriving, and he knew that time was of the essence. And so he was riding around as fast as he could, trying to get some Southern general, including Mr. Beauregard, to actually attack the enemy. And he was absolutely beside himself when he got to Beauregard's command camp, because it was after dark and the aide to Beauregard was in his night clothes. And Forrest exploded. Forrest went nuts. He couldn't, what the hell are you doing in your pajamas?
Sure he did. Now, why didn't Ken Burns talk about Nathan Bedford Forrest?
Because Ken Burns had an agenda.
Which didn't include talking about Nathan Bedford Forrest and his brilliant tactics.
Well, I thought that Ken Burns did a long interview with Shelby Foote, multiple interviews with Shelby Foote. He butchered those interviews to get exactly what he wanted into that that series.
That's probably true.
Yeah, the best part of that whole series was the music.
I would have to agree with that.
But I mean that in a more pragmatic way too. I mean that served their agenda. They were using that music to appeal in the pictures. It's all used to create a perspective, a form, an image in your mind. And, the music was powerful, but it helped fulfill the story that they wanted to tell. And that story is a deception. I'll give you a little quote from George Orwell here. It says, "The past was erased. The erasure was forgotten. The lie became the truth." And that's,
yeah.
You do that over about six generations, and you end up with the LGBT serving in the Navy with custom maternity and sodomy suits, so. Beautiful. Wonderful idea, right? So that's,
yeah, it's your LBGT. It is.
It's wonderful. So,
Michael, let's not run out of town. Get to Richmond.
Say again, sir.
Get to Richmond before we run out of time. I want to get that on the record.
Get to Richmond. Oh, yeah, about Lincoln?
Yes, Lincoln and Richmond. Yes.
Okay. Well, Lincoln, after Richmond was defeated and the Battle of Richmond, and Jefferson Davis and Mr. Benjamin headed south with the Confederate gold and trying to get to Texas to continue the Confederacy. When Lincoln went in with a very heavy military presence, I might add, he noticed the absolute devastation, and he commented about it in some notes that are available in the Lincoln papers. And he talked about the what he saw in Richmond when he saw emaciated children, children with their ribs showing, and a lot of you could almost take some of the pictures of those folks from Nazi Germany, and you could use some of those pictures. He commented in his notes about people chasing rats for food. And he was, I believe, it's my belief, and I sell it for what it's worth, my opinion. I'm not saying that this is documented, but I believe that Lincoln, even in his hardness and in his, I believe he was touched. I believe what he saw, the devastation that he saw in Richmond, I believe actually made a difference. And the reason I believe that is because when he got back to Washington, D.C., he told his advisors, and this is in Lincoln's letters as well, he told his advisors that he was going to bring the South back in as his brothers. He said, "The war is almost over. I'm going to bring them back in as brothers. I would like to heal this country." Now, whether that was genuine or whatever, I'm not sure. But that was his comment. And then, when Lee surrenders at Appomattox Courthouse on April the 9th of 1865, then the in the streets of Washington.
Michael.
Was it there, Michael's turn to drop offline now?
That would be perfect for tonight.
No, sure. Yeah,
thunderstorm comes in and takes Mike out.
You guys hear me?
There you go.
Yeah, we got you now.
Hello.
Okay, you dropped out. You're good now. Go ahead, Mike.
Michael Gaddy.
No.
Michael Gaddy.
You guys hear me?
Yeah.
Come on. Come on, Mike. Are you there? Maybe.
Mike. Michael Getty. Did we lose him? Damn, just was getting good.
It always happens that way. I think that what little bit of background I've had on this particular area, Robert, was that as Lincoln had indicated earlier in his concerns about the bankers to the back of him and these other forces that were arrayed against him in the North, came to bear after the war. There was in any number of speeches there after Richmond, he had indicated his willingness and desire to have a reconciliation and not a reconstruction. And this was an anathema. It was a horrible thing for the bankers that wanted a return on their investment. And they needed to, which then led into this period of time known as the carpetbaggers, where they looted and pillaged the South. Of course, this was in the absence of Lincoln. And so it's some supposition and speculation on my part, but I believe towards the end of the war or after the war, it wasn't Lincoln's intent to actually loot and pillage the South. It was reconciliation, and the bankers couldn't allow that investment to be lost, which would have been the case. It's interesting to note that Wilkes Booth and a number of all the other operatives that were associated with that were part of the Golden Triangle, which was a sect of the Freemasonry, and were banker agents. So, that's what little bit I can contribute to that aspect of the story. So. Michael, did you come in back yet? I don't see him.
Yeah,
yet.
You should be back on the call. Michael, are you there?
Yeah, can you hear me, guys?
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, come on.
Well, I'm not sure what happened. I just suddenly had no connection. So, the thing of it is, I've always wondered about this because I'm sitting here with two internet connections that both say they're giving me strong signal, and yet I'm cut out anyway.
Well, it's no such agency, Michael. No such agency.
come on, Michael, while you're on. Let's get Richmond.
Go ahead.
Okay, where was I when I was so eloquently dropped off?
Bring in the South as brothers.
Well, Lincoln had said that to his cabinet, and then I heard Darrell. Thanks for coming in with that. I knew you had the info as well. But he wanted to bring the South back as brothers, and he told his cabinet that. And then when the band is playing and marching in the streets, and they go to where Lincoln was, and he comes outside, and they said, "All right, Mr. President, the South has surrendered. What song would you like to hear?" And he said, "I would like to hear Dixie." I think that was the final nail in his coffin,
so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not sure. Johnny Horton, a country music singer, was a historian, and he put in his song, Johnny Reb, that Lincoln ordered the band to play Song Dixie for you, Johnny Reb, and for all that you believed. Now, I don't know the second part of that. I can find that, but I guess it works good if you're writing a song.
Certainly so.
So, yes, I believe that Lincoln had a change of heart. I'm not saying it was a total transformation. But I believe that, he was touched somehow on that trip to Richmond because he changed. He changed.
Michael, can we pick up the trail of those intents of Lincoln's policy towards the South after his assassination and going forward with presidency of Andrew Johnson? Were there aspects of that in Andrew Johnson's policies going forward? Is it related to the South?
Well, it wasn't Johnson. Johnson opposed almost everything that the radical Republicans was trying to do. He vetoed the Reconstruction Act of 1867, but he was overridden in the Congress. That's the reason they tried to impeach him.
That's my point. That was my point. My question was that it occurs to me that Andrew Johnson is trying to follow on with what we're suggesting Lincoln's intent was after the war, and Andrew Johnson paid a dear price for it politically. So
he's probably good as he could have been given the circumstances relative to his predecessor.
Yes, I would certainly agree with that, Robert. He certainly was. And Daryl, take it for just a second. I'm trying to find something that Johnson said in my notes here. So if you got a second,
kind of
talk for a second, sir.
You know, Andrew Johnson, when presented with the 14th Amendment, in the Rump Congress at the time, stated that he had no authority, that there was no authority in the Constitution for the basis of bringing the 14th Amendment in, and also with the Articles of Reconstruction that were presented, and I think he referred to it as there's a legal term for what they were going to do to the South. It was a bill of attainder. Also, there was the radical Republicans brought in legislation for people who had been a part of the rebellion and the confiscation of their property, which he was definitely against. And all these things included during the terms of Andrew Johnson, who was from a southern state, which is little known or even cared about, resulted in the Articles of Impeachment being drawn up against him. And it was the legislation was forced through with the radical Republicans. So, you know, we have an interesting period here right after the war, and Andrew Johnson plays a really big part in that. So did you find what you were looking for, Michael?
Yes, sir. I have it. I did. It just took me just a couple of minutes there. Thank you, Daryl. But happened is that the southern states, as I said before, would have to ratify the 14th Amendment. And as Senator Doolittle from Wisconsin said after the South had rejected the 14th Amendment, he said, and I quote, "The people of the South have rejected the constitutional amendment, and therefore we will march upon them and force them to adopt it at the point of the bayonet." So Andrew Johnson vetoes the Reconstruction Act of 1867 with the following words. He says, "The Reconstruction Act is an absolute despotism and a bill of attainder against 9 million people." And he says that such a power has not been wielded by any monarch in England for more than 500 years.
And what is the bill of attainder?
Well, you just basically take away all the rights.
Okay.
So, yep. He vetoed it. He kept vetoing these moves by the rump Congress. He kept vetoing them over and over. They kept overriding him. They got tired of fighting with him over this stuff. They kept tired of having to go back and veto and override all the vetoes. So what happened was that they told him, the Congress told the president, okay, you cannot hire or fire anybody in your cabinet. So they said, we're in charge of your cabinet. So Andrew Johnson, if I believe I'm correct in this, he fired Ulysses S. Grant, removed Ulysses S. Grant from Secretary of War. And when he did, they impeached him, drew up articles of impeachment. Daryl, do you have any information on that per se?
Well, I can provide Robert and everybody listening with the exact definition of a bill of attainder, and it's pretty important. Bills of attainder are legislative acts, no matter what their form, that apply either to named individuals or to easily ascertainable members of a group. Now, this would be like the 10 states of the South. That would be an easily ascertainable group. Okay, that's who bills of attainder would apply to in legislative acts, or members of a group in such a way as to inflict punishment on them without a judicial trial. So bills of attainder are actually legislative decrees on definable groups, and I would give you a really good example of that that is looming above us right now, which is additional gun registration restriction and ultimately confiscation. That would be like the equivalent, in my opinion, of a bill of attainder, which is it's really, really important to understand. Go ahead, Mark.
Got it.
Well, I thought it was not only did Johnson, when he vetoed this, not only did the radical Republican Congress, not only did they override Johnson's veto, but they also voted in statutes that shrank the Supreme Court's appellate jurisdiction. So to make sure that the courts didn't override the tyranny that the Congress was doing at that time, these wonderful Republicans, to make sure that they counteracted them, they said, they wrote statutes that said that what their opinions were not appealable to the Supreme Court.
Wow.
That would almost make them like gods, wouldn't it?
Yes, totally. Well, where's our friend Dolph and Dave here? Dave, you got some comments before we run out of time, my friend?
Well, yeah. I think Daryl brought up some good points about gun registration and the similarities, you know, between what happened then and what's going on now. You know, this story always seems to remain the same on so many different levels when we have these discussions about history. That's what makes it so fascinating to me personally.
Let me, if I can, because we're about out of time.
Go ahead, Daryl. I just want to
read you a quote from somebody who will bolster our point here on this matter about this period in time and Reconstruction. And it comes from a very awkward source, actually. It's Horace Greeley before he dies. Right before he dies in 1872. And this is a quote, and he's aggravated, and he says, we have stricken the slave shackles from 4 million human beings and brought all laborers to a common level, not so much by the elevation of the former slaves as by practically reducing the whole working population, white and black, to a condition of serfdom. While boasting of our noble deeds, we are careful to conceal the ugly fact that by an iniquitous money system, we have nationalized a system of oppression. which though more refined, is not less cruel than the old system of chattel slavery. Does that give you chills, people? This is written in about 1870. So
the words of the man who wrote them.
Yeah. Well, source documents.
Here's the thing, Robert. If Horace Greeley could have changed that much before he passed away, do you not think that Lincoln might have changed his feathers a little bit right after Richmond?
Given the previous almost 120 minutes, yeah, I guess I have to make that admission, yeah.
Well, I just want to take, we've got about a minute or so left, and I just wanted to take the time to thank all of you, especially you, Robert, you, Daryl, and Dave, for jumping in here and participating in this conversation, because I'm going to guarantee you that there's not going to be too many other places that people are going to hear these subjects covered in this kind of detail.
Roger that. Real quick. And how did they get rid of the real 13th Amendment, the one that said lawyers couldn't serve? How'd they pull that one off?
Say again, Robert.
The original 13th Amendment, the one that said lawyers can't be in the Senate. How did they get rid of that one?
Well, they just ignored it. How did they get rid of how did they pass gun laws? They just ignored the Second Amendment.
With Robert, with the stroke of a pen.
Yeah.
All right, guys. See you next week, folks, on the wonderful Addicted to Your Own Destruction. Thanks, guys. Talk to you next week.
Bye-bye.
All right, good night.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio.
We're an anarcho-syndicalist commune. We take it in turns to act as a sort of executive officer for the week.
Yes.
But all the decisions of that officer have to be ratified at a special bi-weekly meeting.
Yes, I see.
By a civil majority in the case of purely internal affairs.
Be quiet.
But by a two-thirds majority in the case of more...
Be quiet. I order you to be quiet.
Look, you stupid bastard, you've got no arms left.
Yes, I have.
Look!
It's just a flesh wound.
I don't believe I've seen such a display of courage, skill, nerve, grace, and stupidity.
I'll do you for that.
Oh, what?
Come here.
What are you going to do, bleed on me?
I'm invincible.
You're a loony.
The Black Knight always triumphs.
Roundtable Live, Monday through Friday, 1 a.m. till 4 a.m. Eastern Time. Bring your mind, bring your ideas, bring your voice. King Arthur had nothing on us. Here, Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com.
Transcending time and space, let us take you to the place inside your mind where thoughts divide and mysteries unwind. Join us every Monday evening right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time. And you will catch the Fenton Perspective with our great host, Lorian Fenton. Come listen in as she shares her amazing stories from the past to present, along with all of her guest secrets.